BSing with
who?
BSing with
what?
BSing with Sean K. BSing with
who?
BSing with
what?
You're listening to BSing with Sean K on Radio Free Brooklyn. I am your host, Sean East. The K is silent. And on this show, I BS with people who live outside the box,
providing a platform for opinions and perspectives not often heard in the mainstream media. For this episode, I'm going to play you a conversation I had with Jeff Fio Eliscas. He's a writer, and I guess I would describe his writing as prose, very personal. It's very dark, sometimes deals with depression and also some experiences he's had in his own life. And I became familiar with his writing through Facebook, but I knew him because I originally met him a few years ago when I did an article on and a podcast related to the Thursday night punk rock nights at Otto's Shrunken Head. And I interviewed DJ Pat Pervert, who's also, I mean, his real name is Pasquale Santoro. And Thursday nights he does this punk rock themed DJ set at Otto's Shrunken Head in Alphabet City in New York, New York. And I actually, Jeff was in my article I wrote about the punk rock night, but I didn't know his name at the time, so I quoted him in it, but I didn't mention his name. And in the article he talked about being a skinhead, but not a racist skinhead. And a lot of people, when they think of skinheads, they think of the far right. But originally it was a movement that was just about working class pride, and it was apolitical and it was racially inclusive. As time went on, the far right started, I guess the only time it was ever in the news when there was these violent far right groups who identified as skinheads. And then there were groups like SHARP, which is Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. But I don't want to give too much away about that because he describes that in detail in the interview. And anyway, here's the conversation, and I hope you enjoy it.
So how did you, I want to get into your writing, but I also want to ask, how did you become exposed to like the skinhead movement, and what, and for people who are unfamiliar, like what is that exactly? Like, I know a lot of people, like they would, when they hear skinhead, they think of like, you know, like the neo-Nazi skinheads and all that. A lot of people now, I don't think, know about like the non-racist skinheads that came first. It was more just like a working class movement.
As far as my exposure to it, I actually didn't get exposed to it in the States. I got exposed to it in Guatemala, which is where my parents are from. And I went to Guatemala shortly after the Civil War. And in Guatemala, they have Jamaican immigrants. And especially where my mom, the city where my mom is from, Xela, is where I spent a lot of my time. And so they're... Latin America in general, subcultures and music is huge. And that's where I got into it. But I was exposed to the music, to skinhead reggae. And then I noticed how some of my cousins' friends had short cropped hair, and they kind of looked like American preppy boys, but they had these like, you know, combat boots. And I thought they looked kind of cool, you know, and then I enjoyed the music, and then I was only 15 at the time. And when you're 15, you know, you're trying to discover yourself. I remember when I was 15, I went through a fucking Jim Morrison phase, you know, where I would wear fake leather pants and walk around with a book of Jim Morrison poems, you know. And and I was also really into hip hop and breakdancing and stuff. But when I went to Guatemala, I was exposed not only to just that subculture, but to the realities of what working class is compared to a United States working class or English working class to a third world working class, where skinheads or punks or metalheads, their lives are in danger because it's more common that they join street gangs or stuff like that, but instead they rebel by finding subcultures. But then I went to like I said, they played a lot of reggae out in Guatemala, and it was a lot of classic reggae. And I remember walking with my cousin down, you know, my memory is very it's been so long, but there was a little outdoor reggae sound party. They had these speakers, and the DJs were, you know, a reggae guy. They were Jamaicans, and then you see these like guys with shaved heads, no shirts on, with braces and skinhead tattooed, not very well. And then, you know, when you come back to the States, you're like, oh, it's, you know, it's different in the States. Here it's more, it looked very more militant, kind of like in the early hardcore scenes where skins wore camouflage pants and the 20 lit boots and stuff like that. And unfortunately, when I came back to the States, I think that movie, American History X, came out. And so that completely changed, you know, everyone's opinion of what that movement was, but for me it wasn't like that. And skinheads I met coming back to the States, the ones in New York, the ones in Houston, the ones in from Mexico, I never viewed them, they had no political opinion really, so they educated me more into what it was, because before that I also saw it as a far-right movement. It wasn't really a problem. And then around 2003-04, that, you know, the internet, you know, became more, you know, everybody was exposed to it. And then you did all these websites. I remember there used to be a website called American Skinhead, and you would read these beautiful articles written, I don't even remember by who, about the New York scene and the Bowery and stuff like that, and how in America it started in New York. And then you would read more about the SHARP movement, the acronym, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, and which was when I was in my late teens, that was becoming more of a thing. You started seeing flyers for them everywhere. And then in the 80s, I think late 80s, Roddy Moreno from The Oppressed, the Oi Skinhead band from England, played in New York. He saw a flyer and was so inspired by it that he took it to England, and there the SHARP movement's huge. But for me, like I just as I got older, and you know I've always identified with my working class heritage, my pride of working class, you know, my parents working class, you know, and my immigrant upbringing, you know, was very important to me. And I always saw skinheads as, I guess, like a brotherhood, or people who are always there for you. I love punks and goths, but there was always an attitude problem with that, where punks were constantly asked, no one's more punk than that one punk you talk to. No one, you know, if you talk to a goth, they're not goth. They just like to wear black and listen to goth rock. When you talk to skins, it's either, hey, dude, let me buy you a beer. Or sometimes there is that attitude. I mean, there is toughness to it. Let's get that. You know, there's also a violent tendency towards it. But they were always the ones that just didn't really give a fuck.
You're saying that you think they were less about fitting an image than...
Yeah, exactly. It just didn't matter. It was... You know, and at least then, I mean, I can't speak for not what it's like now. I mean, now there's definitely it seems more fashion based, you know. And it's back then, I remember when you couldn't even afford a Fred Perry, you know. So when you met a skinhead who had one, you were like, holy shit! Like, how many hours of work did you put in for that, you know? Or like to see somebody with like. Like even the Ben Sherman, you know, it was very rare. And back then, like, you had to go online to order it, and it was more expensive and stuff like that. For me, it was more about, you know, just the attitude, the, you know, the boots, of course, and just, you know, sticking together. It's like every tribe has that. Hmm. Yeah. Every tribe has that. When I lived in Houston, that was my favorite as far as like where scenes are, because everyone got along. It didn't matter what you were. You would go to a punk show, a punk party, a punk rocker who was having a party. There were skinheads, there were metalheads, there were goths, your occasional crusty here and there, but it didn't really matter what the fuck you were, or even people who didn't like it or know anything about it. We all just hung out and had fun, and that's all it was about. And when you're young, it's great. It's a great way to, you know, we all need to have that kind of, because this, you know, society's boring at best, you know, and when you're a teenager, you know, there's only certain things you can get into. And I always found, like, for example, in high school, I was limited to friendships. I didn't have many friends. I read a lot. You know, books and music were my friends. That was my thing. I used to go to Barnes & Noble every weekend just to read. And I used to go to record shops all the time. And, you know, you have, you know, in high school, there's all these different classes of tribes. You have the jocks, you have the preppies, you have the thug kids, the cholos, which, you know, and then you had like the immigrant kids that no one accepted. And then you had the stoners and the skaters, and they all got along. And I kind of went towards them more because I felt that I understood them more, but in reality I didn't like it. And they were, you know, to them it was all about smoking pot and listening to Led Zeppelin. I didn't like it. I forced myself to kind of like it, but deep down I knew there was something that about it that wasn't me. And then when I was 16, I you know, like I said, I was a big fan of the Doors. And it was more, not even just their music, but the poetry of Jim Morrison, which now I don't think I like it as much as I discovered more and more poets, especially American poets. But that was a big thing for me. And then through that, I discovered the Velvet Underground. And there was this PBS show I used to watch about rock and roll subcultures, and they talked about the first like out there bands. And the segment was on the Doors, which I already knew about, the Velvet Underground, which I wasn't really familiar with, Iggy Pop, and David Bowie. And I was blown away by what the Velvet Underground were doing. So when in high school, I would do my research, I'd go to school, I'd type in Velvet Underground, Lou Reed, and then it sent you to a link about Iggy Pop, and that link would send you to the Ramones and this and that. So like that's where I identified myself. I remember telling a friend of mine that I had who was my neighbor, and every time I found some kind of type of music, I would share it with him. And I remember, it's like, dude, I don't think we're stoners, because we're not, you know, we don't smoke pot, we drink beer, you know. And I was like, I think we're called punks. And through that, I got into more American writers, especially the Beats. And I've always written, and I've always liked how the style of how punks were writing. I love that, you know, that kind of attitude they had towards conformity. And then when Oi, I enjoyed more, I related with it more because it was more talking about working, you're working, not making money. You know, the money you make, you spend on your boots. The money you make, you spend on the drinking with your friends and soccer. And, you know, I grew up with that. So I just went more towards that. And then as I got older, I learned more and more where it came from England in the 60s, from the Jamaican immigrants moving to England, and then the mods who were inspired by the music and the image that these Jamaicans were bringing to their country and to their scene. And I just, it's very fascinating, but it's also upsetting how it just became bastardized into one label of politics.
Yeah. And have you ever had people, like when you say you were a skinhead, assume you meant that you were a racist or something like that?
Yes. Especially in the past 4 years. Yes. I've almost lost jobs because of my tattoos. I've had, let me see, there was this one incident I had where I was asked to leave a bar because I went in boots and braces, and I went in with a group of my friends who, you know, they were you know, artists, you know, and the bartender refused to serve me. I've had people who thought I was a Nazi and they were far right. I've had incidents where I was working at the bar, especially nowadays with what's going on politically, thinking I was a member of the Proud Boys, and they'd give me a handshake doing their little Proud Boy thing, and I'd tell them to fuck off. You know? I remember I was at a bar once where I met a good friend of mine, her boyfriend. I've never met him, and when I met him, the first thing he did was give me the Hitler salute, and I was very offended by it. You know, I've been on dates where girls would ask what's with the tats, and I explained it to them, and I would never hear back from them again. But but it comes with the territory, man. That's what it is, dude. It comes with the territory, and you either can have a sit down and explain it for an hour, or you can just be very nice and generous to them, and or be very, like, you know, an intellect about it. Or sometimes you can just be like, fuck off.
So how did the interest in reading and writing start?
The interest in reading and writing came as I always had a fascination with books. And the first poet I got into was Shel Silverstein. As a kid, I thought he was amazing. And so I would write little poems and stuff like that. And then I read this, it was like an essay about Martin Luther King Jr. So I bought a book on about him, and I thought it was powerful. You know, even though I was very young, I thought what his message of, you know, said, you know, being and all that was very powerful. So I saw him at that age as an influence. And then I got into Stephen King when I was 9. But the first book I read was Cujo. And then I read Pet Sematary. And then by the time I was 10 years old, I was already reading adult novels and stuff like that. And it just went on from there, from then music and then getting into the American writers and the Beats and stuff like that. But I was, you know, very fortunate because, you know, I used to read newspapers all the time as a kid. I kind of taught myself how to read. So, but yeah, there was something about Shel remembering how much his poems were so simple, but so fascinating. And the artwork as well. And then, like, reading that essay on Dr. Martin Luther King was, it's still in my head. You know, I was only like 6, I think. I'm 36 now, so it had an impact. I didn't remember what the essay was. I just remember owning it and reading it. And then Stephen King somehow came to my life. You know, I think when you're those introverted young kids and you're into horror films and comic books, there's somehow Stephen King kind of becomes a part of that, you know. And so yeah, those were my early influences. And not only that, but like comic books, you know, whatever Stan Lee wrote, even articles from like Playboy, for example, were interesting to read as a child, which is, you'd rather look at the women, and which I did, but like you have articles in there that are pretty good, and but yeah, those are my early influences as a writer, as a young age at least. So.
Yeah, and I guess would you describe your writing as prose? Because I read it, and I guess that was more like, I guess the style I would say, or more certainly like more direct, I guess is what I say, like not like a lot of metaphors, but more just like describing like your experiences and like kind of short passages. That's why at least I've seen of your writing.
Right. You know, it's definitely direct. You could call it prose. I wouldn't even know how to explain it, because I remember when I didn't really get into poetry or really take into it until my late 20s. When I used to bartend in the West Village. And it was like Monday, you know, no one ever drinks, but I'm a good storyteller. So there was this woman used to come in every Monday, and we would talk, and I would tell her all stories about my life and she was like, you should write these down. They're pretty interesting. And she was not the first person to do that. And then once I met someone from France who, after meeting her, just really inspired me. It's like, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to take this more seriously. Because like in my mid-20s to my late-20s, I would, you know, would have like a something in my head that I liked, and I would write it down and just like put it in a shelf or something like that. And then when I was, how old was I? 24, I saw Teenage Jesus and Jerks at the Knitting Factory, which is a big, I love Lydia Lund. She's a huge inspiration for me as a writer. So after seeing that, me and the friends I had at the time were like, let's start a no wave band. So I started writing all these shitty kind of crappy songs. And but then I saved some of what I thought sounded good. And then when I got older, I just said, fuck it. This is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to express myself. And it was also a great way to express to, it's therapeutic because, you know, at the time, you know, not everyone's 100% mentally. So when you can write down how you're feeling instead of talking to someone about it, I think that's a little better way. So I wouldn't really know how. I guess you could say it's direct. I guess you could say, I mean, it's modern. There's a lot of New York in it. You know, New York is definitely an inspiration. There's a lot of mental health in it. There's a lot of, you know, like substance abuse in it. But there's also love in it. There's reality in it. And that's the only, that's not, I wouldn't know how to describe it, really.
So what is... been like some of your most meaningful pieces or ones that you've written that have like really stuck with you?
I think that the one poem I wrote, there's a couple that's really stuck to me. They're the ones I usually do, I perform when I recite, which, you know, unfortunately, there's a poem I wrote called Bellevue Blues. And it was about my experience there. And that's always been kind of like an inspiration.
And just to clarify for the listeners, when you say Bellevue, you're referring to Bellevue Hospital in New York, right? The famous public hospital that's one of the oldest public hospitals and has been used in literature and TV. And a lot of people go there for mental health services.
Right. Right. And the poem is just talking about someone who's, you know, you think you're crazy, but then you see people that are far more psychotic than you are. But you feel for them, but you also feel that you are one of them. You know, you feel that sense of insanity and that mental state you're in. But when I wrote that poem, I performed it, I think it was 2013, at this bar called Old Man Hustle. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I haven't heard of it.
No. It's in the Lower East Side. It's a very small bar. And it's a comedy bar now, but they have a little stage and they had an open mic thing. And Reverend Jen was having, I think it was her birthday party or something. So what she used to do was she would do anti-slams, which there's a lot of slam poetry, which I personally don't like slam poetry. I think poetry should be heard, not scored. So she had this anti-slam, and a friend of mine asked if I wanted to do a poem for it. And it was last minute, and I didn't know what poem to write. And I was like, oh, I just wrote a poem called Poetry Blues. You know? Wrote it down, and, you know, didn't have time to memorize it. So I go to this Old Man Hustle, and it's packed with all these writers and artists and, you know, who've been around for years. So when I went up and did the poem, I didn't know how to do it. I didn't want to just recite it like a poet, like a typical poet. So I would sing the verse in between and snap my fingers, and that caught people's attention. And every time I recite that poem, it gets people's attention. And so that one definitely is up there for me as the top one of the poem, not only that I recite, but the one people always tell me about. And then there's one called Ink Stains. And Ink Stains is a, I wrote that. There was a period between 2013 and 15 where I just wrote every single day. And I would write at bars, of course. Just write on cocktail napkins. If I had a journal, I'd write on the journal, you know. Go home, wasted, you'd wake up, you had no idea what happened, what you wrote, but I would always find these little cocktail napkins of poems I'd write, or these long long pages from paper towel rolls or whatever. So there was a long, like those years where I was just writing nonstop, where I wrote most of the poetry books are written. But Ink Stains, I was one of my, a big one for me, because it was like, I think the last time we had a bad snow year in like 2014. And, you know, I live in a little studio. There's no good lighting. You know, the winter can be tough for people. You know, you get seasonal depression. And I wrote Ink Stains. It was the verse, the introduction, the verse is, I have two tabs open. Forgot to eat. The studio has no lightings and it smells like cigarettes, but I don't smoke. You know, and that's pretty much a poem about alcohol and depression.
So you have kind of a seasonal thing. Then I guess, so you talk about like if it rains or so the weather kind of affects like how you feel.
I mean, I guess you could say that. I mean, that because it was really cold, you know, so like, and it lasted so long, but like that struck a chord with me because I noticed that was my habit was, I'm going to this bar and then I'm going to keep my tab open. I'm going to another bar and I'm going to keep my tab open. I'm going to go home and sleep it out and do the same thing, but it's fucking cold out. And, you know, I just wrote about that experience and that, you know, and how kind of mentally unhealthy it was. But when I wrote that, that got a lot of people, like, you know, enjoyed it. And then there was a Nowhere Else to Go, which is about New York, how much I love New York, but I have nowhere. I feel like there's nowhere else for me to go, you know. And when that one started, the intro to that is like, New York, I have nowhere else to go. Like, New York, I have nowhere else to be a working stiff and a late night drinker. You know, do you remember that one time, New York, when I died in Brooklyn? You know, it's just, you know, or New York, we are survivors. You know, and that mentality of surviving, especially in a city like this, especially in times like this, you know,
yeah,
something like that could be very inspirational. I mean, I get judged a lot too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, every artist is going to have some sort of negative kind of feedback, which is good. You know, I've had people complain that, you know, your writing is too much about drinking, but the thing is, well, it kind of helps, you know, but it's not always about that. I have love poems that I've written that mean a lot to me. There's criticism and then there's just straight up judgment on what you write, negativity. And like I said, people are like, oh, well, it's too depressing, or it's too, you know, the subjects are too much of that of alcoholism or depression. It's like, well, yeah, what do you think inspires? It's not that it inspires me. It's I do it because that's what I'm letting out. And it's not that I'm trying to depress someone. I feel like it's good for people who have any kind of mental health issues. At least they can know there's someone there for them. If you read my poems, there's always going to be a positive note to it. You know, even if they're even like the loved ones that I have.
Yeah, it's kind of like what you said before. Like you think you're crazy, then you find someone else is more crazy. It's like someone could read that and like not, they could be thinking like, I'm the only one who goes through these feelings, right? I'm the only one who has the experiences. But then they read one of your poems and then they realize, you know, they're not so unusual. There's other people that
exactly. I mean, things. I think it's important to inspire people to not be so down on whatever's going on in their lives, to know there's someone out there who's going through it too. I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm writing about it and I just don't want that to be like a stereotype. Like, for example, everyone loves Charles Bukowski. I do not. And I remember I've had people pretty much almost throw drinks at my face because I don't like Bukowski. And the reason I don't, I like his quotes. But when you read his poems, it's like what he did for the day. There's nothing poetic about it. I woke up today and drank a bottle of wine. And I got in my car and saw a traffic girl and masturbated. And then went to the horse track and lost money. I mean, that's not poetry to me. That's a boring day for a man. But for some reason, people fucking love it.
Well, I guess he was kind of like an anti-poet in a way. That was like the thing. I guess that was kind of like his signature. Like his poems were just kind of like basic. But he did write that one thing about like, so you want to be a writer, which I really liked. I think that was my favorite poem I read by him. And I liked Post Office.
That's good. But he was also post of that when it was going on with the American writers at the time. You know, he wasn't like part of the East Coast scene or the San Francisco writers renaissance. You know, he was too busy traveling or too busy living his life out in LA. But he also started out late at an age when it came to poetry and stuff like that. But even though I don't like his writing, doesn't mean I don't respect him. But it's all booze.
Yeah.
That's all it is, you know? And you can say that about my working, but I think it's beyond that.
Yeah, that's why I thought, that's why I thought it was interesting you said you didn't like Bukowski, because you said that you write a lot about booze. And I thought, oh, maybe you were inspired by him, but then you said you didn't like him too much.
So. Yeah. And people really get shocked by that. I mean, but you know, one of my favorite writer, my favorite poets, really, it's Jack Kerouac.
Oh, really? And, on the Road, or that's the only thing I've read by him. But.
Oh, it's great. No, his poetry is good. Poems of all sizes. My favorite poem he's ever written is "Mexico City Loneliness." It's such a great, great poem. It's, you can totally relate with what this guy was going through. And again, he was, you know, shit, who knows how much he drank. I mean, that's what killed him. But I feel all writers have that kind of sense. There's something about mental health issues and substance abuse that just draws them to that. Like Ernest Hemingway, you know, like my favorite poet, Alejandro Pizarnik, you know, from Argentina. For some reason, I mean, there's just that sense of, it just goes hand in hand, unfortunately.
You know what I mean? Kind of using it as a catharsis poetry, you mean?
In a way, as it's a vice, you know. It's like one of my poems. It's called Depression, and it's small. It's just depression kills, as do all my vices. You know, we all have vices, whether it's drinking, whether it's smoking, cocaine, heroin addiction, sex, you know, video games. You know, it's like we all have a vice, you know. Just try to use that vice and find ways to use it for art, I guess is what you can say.
Yeah, like in ways that don't destroy you, like using your negative, negative, your demons for something positive.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, I mean, that's the way I see it. But that's me. I mean, I've been called out on stage once, which I thought was amazing. I really did. I was at it was the beginning of, it was January 1st, 2016. And I went to a poetry reading at the New Eurekan, which is a great place. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's in the East Village or Alphabet City.
I don't think so.
Oh, it's great. Every Wednesday they have poetry. You know, it's a great place. Ginsberg used to read there. But anyways, I went, they had an open mic thing, and I went, someone I knew at the time convinced me to go there. And I was like, okay, it's New Year's Day. I have nothing else better to do. And so I go, and then I recited Bellevue Blues, because that's the one that, you know, it's more than just a poem. There's theater to it. I'm acting for it, you know. I'm trying to put passion in it. And, you know, I got a good response. People were like, oh, it was great. And then this one poet, I wish I remember her name, and she showed up with a binder, as if she was like in high school. It was like one of those binders and all these poems in there. And she was like, I don't know who this fail guy thinks he is, but he doesn't know anything about Bellevue. I'm going to tell him what Bellevue's like. And so she was flipping through pages, and she was like, aha! And she read the poem, and people kind of looked at me like, wow, that kind of sucked. Like, why did she do that? And I applauded her. I stood up. I gave her my own standing ovation because I was like, you don't even know me, but I'm glad you did it. And so as I was leaving, we were leaving for, you know, the show was over. It was time to go. I didn't want to mingle. And so I saw her sitting, and I went up to her. I was like, excuse me, I don't know you, but my name is Feo. And I'm honored that you called me out on stage, that you took the time to have the be so angry with someone you didn't know about a poem that I find it really honored, because if it makes you upset that badly, that means I'm doing something right. So happy new year and go fuck yourself. and as we're leaving, I'm walking down 4th Street towards B, and you can hear her just screaming at me, Feo, fuck you, Feo. That was my favorite moment. It was a great moment.
So she just took the poem personally, is what you're saying?
I guess so. But it was great. I thought it was, you know, I like it. If people were that upset, that means you're doing something right.
Yeah, well, it's good that she cared that much about your work. So I see what you mean. Yeah.
Well, I enjoy the fact. I mean, for me, I'm not gonna lie. I get a kick out of people who are like, "Oh, Fayol's writing is crap. What's the point? Don't fucking bother." I get a thrill off that, because that's what people told me about the Velvet Underground. And so I went and read it or heard it and said, these guys are fucking wrong. But then again, there is that part when you get that criticism where you're like, wow, especially when it's a fellow writer of yours, where you're like, wow, that kind of sucked. You know, like, it can get to you, but sometimes I like the, that kind of, if someone's going to think about your work so much, or you, to the point where it's, they just, for me, that's just them doing something right. You're doing your job, you know?
Yeah. And I guess you don't really grow as a writer or any kind of artist if you can't take criticism.
Right. Exactly.
Some kind of someone not liking your stuff. It's like when you receive that criticism or that negativity, then that's almost like a way you can kind of like, that's an opportunity to kind of strengthen yourself.
Exactly. I mean, we're all going to get criticized for something, be it writing, being whatever you do as work, being yourself, you know, you're always going to have that. It comes with the territory of not just being an artist, but in life. You know, yeah. People go to work, they have good jobs, but nothing's ever perfect for their bosses. Or, you know, you work in the bar, you bar back, either the customer's never happy with you, or as a bar back, you're never fast enough. Or, you know, it's just, this world's not perfect. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's like either you like lock yourself in a room and don't do anything, or you deal with criticism. So it's like,
Funny, I was talking to a friend of mine today, Dave Michalowski. He's a writer too. He's actually done work for the New York Times and stuff like that. And we were kind of talking about how it's weird these days. For anyone can be an artist now. Anyone can be a writer because of blogs. Anyone can be famous because of Instagram and all that. Very rarely do you see people with books. Like, I went to the beach yesterday, and I had a Hemingway book on me, and I looked around, and everyone's on their phones. And I'm not going to lie, I get on my phone a lot, but it's like, where's that, you know, that I want to read something, that sense of having something physical on you.
Yeah.
And then the writer starting off, that you're always going to have, you're going to get criticism, and you're going to get, you never know when you're going to make it. You know, I've been rejected. I talk to Dave about it all the time. I've been rejected so many times where it kind of makes you want to give up. But when I post poems and people who I've never even met enjoy it, I mean, even being invited to your show about it, it's an honor for me, because at least someone is out there paying attention. And then sometimes I tell myself, if it gets published, you know, it's poetry. It's not really going to go anywhere. But at the same time, it would be kind of cool. Instead of saying, oh, I'm a laborer. Oh, I'm a writer.
Yeah, and I guess people, like, don't read published poetry as often now, I guess, as they used to. Is what you're saying. So, like, I don't know if there's really, like, so there's not as many famous poets coming out now, probably.
And not that I know of, to be honest with you. I mean, besides the poets of the past, I mean, my favorite poets are people that I know personally. You know, David Masalski, Erica Duchensky, Bobby Mother Rockstar from the West Village, Claire Trevien she's based from France and England. As in people who not only just write, but are great as photography. Alice Maria from France. These are people that I know. You know, Danny Robinson from England. Amazing writer. It's an amazing poet. Just her work is astounding for me. You have Justin Booth, is based out of down south. He's an amazing writer. But you know, these are people that you kind of either you know personally. You know, and some of them have their work out there. Some of them don't. I think a lot of these people do deserve it. I think somebody like Mother Rockstar of the West Village deserves to have her books out there. She has character. She has a way to draw you. She can walk up to a small group of people in the street and recite a poem, and before you know it, she sees them and they want more. There's artists like Erica Duchensky, who I feel is an amazing, not only just writer, but artist, an amazing artist, whatever it is. Paintings, writing, music, perhaps. These people need to be discovered. People like Jimmy Wellaby, of course, is a great, he's a Swedish poet, but you know, it's I feel like this should be out now. There's hundreds of people you can say deserve, that should get published, should get recognition. But unfortunately, in this society, it's about blogs, it's about discussing the movie you saw on YouTube, or what's new in fashion.
Yeah. You know,
it's kind of been dumbed down. I mean, there's still great writers out there. Another one of my favorite writers is TJ English, and he's a crime investigative writer, but his writings are so great, you know? But I just don't remember the last time someone talked about, oh, you gotta get this poem, or you gotta read this guy's stuff, it's so good, or her stuff, it's so good. You know, it's, who knows when that's, especially nowadays, you know? My Kyle Voigt is a great writer, you know, a great poet. But this is all New York, you know, the New York scene.
Yeah.
Of poets. It's small but big at the same time, but it's all separated.
Yeah, the only like super famous poets I see now are like people who do kind of visual poetry or spoken word, and then they do it on either TED Talks or they have like a YouTube channel. It's not like people don't read it. It's not like written and people read it as much. And then there's, of course, like the best-selling authors that are interviewed on like Oprah or like some other show.
Right, exactly.
Or NPR sometimes interviews some writers that have put out books. But usually that's political books.
Yeah, NPR definitely has a political type of, when it comes to that, where I try to avoid politics as much as possible. I'm very apolitical, you know. There's nothing about my writing or that has any form of politics.
Yeah, and what's your view about like audiobooks or iBooks, like are people reading on their phone? Is that, do you think that's not the same as having like a physical copy of the book?
It's interesting you say that. I've never heard an audiobook ever. When I see people with Kindles, I mean, at least they're reading. That's cool. I'm still very back to just having a hardcover or paperback. I enjoy it. I prefer it that way. You know, and it, my eyes don't get strained as much. But audio book, I've never really had the chance to. I don't know which one I would want to hear, because I think it's, for me, when I'm reading a book, that's a whole new world that I'm entering. So the characters kind of develop their own voices in my head. So if I was to hear someone else do it, it would kind of be different for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly, like, for a fiction kind of thing, it wouldn't work. I feel like audiobooks, like, if it's like some kind of like, maybe like either a self-development book or like nonfiction book, like I can enjoy an audiobook, but for a fiction book, I kind of want to read like the physical copy. Or, I mean, sometimes I'll read iBooks, but usually I like the, I mean, it, I guess they all have their advantages and disadvantages. Like, it's easier to carry like an iBook with you and read it wherever, but a physical book, also you have like more of a connection with it. Exactly. Kind of like owning a record or a CD has
exactly more of a personal connection with music. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it's also it saves a lot of space, because I have so many books in my apartment. That's like when I moved to my own place years ago, the heaviest things I had were my records, my CDs, and my books. And I still, that's my joy, is when I find a box of books, you know, I'm always gonna grab them.
Yeah, and I guess that's why a lot of people find it more convenient just to have it everything on your phone, like books, music, all that.
Yeah, because you can download hundreds of them, you know, and which, you know, in 5 minutes you can download a record, you know, or a novel. Where I enjoy the going to a bookstore, and actually that's how you find different other writers as well, I feel, you know.
Yeah, and well, and the same with music too. Like you're just kind of like drawn to this album or that album that you wouldn't necessarily have discovered otherwise.
Right. It's crazy. I have so many copies of the first Velvet Underground album. I have the CD one I've had since I was 16. I probably have to buy a new one now that I think about it, because I've heard it so much. I have a vinyl where it's a yellow marbled colored record. And then during the pandemic around May, I went walking around with my friend, and someone had a box of records they were throwing out, and they had the first Velvet Underground record, which is, I don't know how people can just throw something like that away, but that's my thing. and I have a lot of copies of On the Road too. I have like the actual one that was released. I have like the ones that were released in the 50s. I have the scroll version, which is the actual scroll.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because you wrote everything on one sheet. That was Kerouac's thing, right? Like,
Yeah. I think it took him 7 weeks to write that. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He was in a diet of coffee and pea soup. And in his room, when he was typing it, he built like a little kind of like cubicle made out of clothes, and it just taped all the paper together and then typed it all in one. And they've done it with others, I heard, but that's the more popular, which is a very interesting way of writing something, to write a novel, I feel.
Yeah, I guess just like kind of like a stream of consciousness or whatever.
Yes. He was a narrative writer, so, you know, he wrote the way, when you read On the Road, it's, you can tell that this guy was, when he was writing this, he was like trying to memorize everything that he had experienced, but he didn't want to lose touch of it. And the way he wrote it, I felt, was so fast that he didn't want to leave anything out of it.
Where would you like to go in the future with your writing?
Publishing would be great. I've been working on a novel. It's been about a year really that I started writing into it, but it's just so hard to get motivation. You'd figure because of the shutdown I would have written more, but I haven't. I've been so lazy about it. But I'd like to get these my novels out, really, and my poetry books, finish this novel, hopefully get that published. finish the second, hopefully get that published, hopefully get some more poetry, hopefully get my, because I've written books, they're just not poetry books, they're just not published. But yeah, just I would like to have be published. And I would, honestly, I would like to do it professionally. You know, be a writer, as a professional writer. So a dream of mine is to move to Paris, to live in Paris and just live my life as a writer.
Oh, is there a big scene for that there? Is there more?
Well, it's funny
because just like the appeal of Paris.
The appeal, because I've never been, but I dream of Paris a lot. I have a lot of poems about Paris. I have some, there's some people in Paris that actually do like my writing. There was one of my poems, Ink Stains, actually, that was the first time I was ever had anything published was a poem of mine. And this was a French zine of poems. And I'm like an idiot. I didn't ask for money. And I never got my copy of the magazine, it's just the appeal of the romanticism.
Like Henry Miller, I think, was one that he was in Paris. So that was where he was.
Yeah. And of course, Ernest Hemingway, you know, Movable Feast, such a great novel.
Yeah. And you said people compare. I saw a post where you said like people have compared your writing to Ernest Hemingway.
No, that was me. His chapters are so short, which is kind of like, for my novel, it's kind of the same style where I write short, like my poems, some of them are short, some of them are long. With this novel I'm writing, it's called It's Like You Know. The titles aren't that, the chapters aren't that long, so neither were Hemingway's, which I noticed that because I've been rereading a lot of his work, but I cannot compare it to him because that guy, you know, was ahead of his, completely a genius as a writer, but even though his chapters were short, the novels were still very long, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he had a lot to say, but in a short and a fast way of doing it as a chapter. It's as if I went to the pub and I had a conversation with somebody, and then I went home, wrote about it, and then that was it. The next day would be the second chapter, I guess.
Yeah, then he had his short stories too. I was just remembering that because you were talking about like bar going to the bars a lot. I was just remembering the A Clean, Well Lighted Place where it was the old man drinking at the bar and all that. I remember I liked that one a lot.
My favorite book, short stories by him, is Men Without Women.
Okay, yeah,
that's a good one. Good one. There's another, Fitzgerald has this book that I like. It's called On Booze, which is his writing on while he drinks. And it's like, you still sound like you're like an intellect, but you're drunk. You know, it's weird. You know, it's like if the characters of Fraser and Niles Crane were drunk, but writing in their vocabulary, you know?
Yeah.
In my opinion, at least.
So you have other favorite, you have drunks you prefer over Bukowski drunk, I guess.
I wouldn't say drunks, but writers,
yeah.
You know, writers. I mean, I don't want to, you know, who idolizes alcoholics? I think that's the last thing you want to be idolized as.
Oh, you think some writers kind of romanticize it a bit maybe? Or?
Oh, yeah, I mean, with the romanticism of it, you know, I guess you could see that, yeah. I mean, but there's also writers who didn't really bring up what their substance abuse problems, I guess.
I guess, is there any final thoughts or anything else you'd like to add?
I just want everybody to stay safe because of what's going on. You said you haven't been back in the city, right?
Yeah, I'm in New Jersey, but like close to the city.
Right.
So,
no, just everyone stay safe. I mean, it's tough times. I hope. Who knows when things will get back to normal. Hopefully we'll be working again and being social again. And I mean, we'll see.
Yeah.
So I can really say, just want everyone to stay healthy. You
know? Yeah. And read, and maybe, this is also a good time for people to do more reading and all that too.
Yeah, reading. Try to be more artistic. Try to find that art, especially if you didn't know anything about it. Like I said, the first 2 months I was painting, but I've never had an interest in it. I did some paintings and I stopped, but like I would like to get back into it. Photography. I'm also really into photography.
Oh yeah, yeah. I saw that on your pit. We didn't really get into too much of that, but you know, we sometimes I have, you know, who knows? Maybe sometimes I have returning guests. Maybe we could go ahead and get into that in another
show. Oh yeah, I mean, if anyone's interested in my photography, I mean, I have an Instagram, Feo NYC.
Yeah, like New York landscapes. It seems to be more like buildings and.
Yeah, I have a thing about it. It's just when I see something, I have to take a picture. Yeah. If you're interested, Feo NYC on Instagram, I'm trying to put more photos on. And if anyone's interested in my poetry, you can always contact me via email, feonyc@gmail.com. So that's how a lot of people get my books of poems.
All right, cool. Well, yeah, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. This was really cool. This was really great.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, good to catch up and all that. And yeah, I look forward to like more of your work and
Thank you. Yeah, I'll definitely keep you posted on that. And hopefully you can come out to Otto's on a Thursday.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like once I guess like more of this stuff like opens up or whatever.
Right. Like, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. Check it out.
Thank you for listening to BSing with Sean K on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Sean K, Sean Neese, and that was my interview with Jeff Feo Eliscas. We covered a lot of territory. We talked about his writing. He's kind of a prose spoken word poet that gets very personal, talks about mental health. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Your support keeps this station going. And if you like listening to Radio Free Brooklyn when you're not in front of your computer, I know a lot of us are always on the go, even during COVID. You know, I've actually been pretty busy here in New Jersey. But please download our Radio Free Brooklyn mobile app from the iPhone store, the App Store for iPhone or the Google Play Store for the Android. And also subscribe to our newsletter, radiofreebrooklyn.com/newsletter. And if you want to donate to help with COVID and everything else, go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate, and you'll find a bunch of merch. You can also use your phone to text RFBGive5, that's the number 5, to 44321. It only takes a moment, and you'll be able to use your digital wallet for your donation. And if you go to Amazon Smile, amazon.com/smile, and register Radio Free Brooklyn as a nonprofit you wish to support, you can get a percentage of your sales will go to Radio Free Brooklyn and it will cost you nothing. I am here on Radio Free Brooklyn Mondays 1 a.m. to 2 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I'm also on Spotify, iTunes, and RadioFreeBrooklyn.com. And that's about it for this week's episode. I'll catch you on the next.
BSing with Sean.